University of Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. November Examination Series 2014. English as a Second Language. Core Tier. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the test. Look at questions 1 to 6. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each item twice. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answers should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. What two things does Jay's mother want from the supermarket?
Jay, will you come with me to the supermarket this afternoon? I need to do a big shop and buy some heavy things. Some boxes of water and a case of lemonade for the party. I'll need some help carrying them out to the car. Luckily, we have plenty of crisps and cans of cola left over from last weekend.
OK, Mum. After all, it is for my birthday party.
Jay, will you come with me to the supermarket this afternoon? I need to do a big shop and buy some heavy things. Some boxes of water and a case of lemonade for the party. I'll need some help carrying them out to the car. Luckily, we have plenty of crisps and cans of cola left over from last weekend.
OK, Mum. After all, it is for my birthday party.
Question 2. What is the boy going to have in his sandwich?
Hi there. And what can I get for you today?
Oh, I'd like a sandwich, please. On white bread. And some fries.
What filling would you like? We have tomato, lettuce, cheese, chicken.
I'd like... I don't like tomatoes. And I had chicken sandwiches yesterday. Have you got tuna, please?
With salad or cucumber?
No, thanks.
Hi there. And what can I get for you today?
Oh, I'd like a sandwich, please. On white bread. And some fries.
What filling would you like? We have tomato, lettuce, cheese, chicken.
I'd like... I don't like tomatoes, and I had chicken sandwiches yesterday. Have you got tuna, please?
With salad or cucumber?
No, thanks.
Question 3. What can the tourists do while they are travelling? Give two details.
Welcome aboard the Happy Holiday coach service. We're on our way to see the Great Wall of China. We expect to reach our destination at about 11 o'clock, so meanwhile you can enjoy the views. We have an audio system on board, so you can listen to music if you wish. When we get there, we have 2 hours for our visit to take photographs and visit the souvenir shops. We'll meet back on the bus at 3 p.m. Welcome aboard the Happy Holiday coach service. We're on our way to see the Great Wall of China. We expect to reach our destination at about 11 o'clock, so meanwhile you can enjoy the views. We have an audio system on board, so you can listen to music if you wish. When we get there, we have 2 hours for our visit to take photographs and visit the souvenir shops. We'll meet back on the bus at 3 p.m.
Question 4. What is the weather going to be like in the morning?
Here is the weather forecast for the next 24 hours. Our satellite picture shows that rain clouds are approaching from the west, so although the day will start quite sunny and bright, this won't last. At 1 p.m., the clouds will reach the coast, and we can expect heavy rain everywhere by mid-afternoon. Good news for farmers after our recent drought, but not so good for holidaymakers. Here is the weather forecast for the next 24 hours. Our satellite picture shows that rain clouds are approaching from the west, so although the day will start quite sunny and bright, this won't last. At 1 p.m., the clouds will reach the coast, and we can expect heavy rain everywhere by mid-afternoon. Good news for farmers after our recent drought, but not so good for holidaymakers.
Question 5. What does Gemma want her friend to lend her?
Hello, Gemma. Did you have a good time last night?
I certainly did. The concert was amazing. I just wish you could have come. You'd have loved it.
I'm sure I would have done. But I had to do that history homework. I hadn't written up the last essay. And then we had to do the research for today's lesson.
Oh, no. You've reminded me. I've already finished the essay, but I don't suppose you'd let me borrow your notes, would you? I'd do the same for you.
Oh, Gemma, not again.
I promise this is the last time, honest. I'll let you borrow the CD of last night's concert.
Hello, Gemma. Did you have a good time last night?
I certainly did. The concert was amazing. I just wish you could have come. You'd have loved it.
I'm sure I would have done. But I had to do that history homework. I hadn't written up the last essay. And then we had to do the research for today's lesson.
Oh, no. You've reminded me. I've already finished the essay, but I don't suppose you'd let me borrow your notes, would you? I'd do the same for you.
Oh, Gemma, not again.
I promise this is the last time, honest. I'll let you borrow the CD of last night's concert.
Question 6. A. What does the customer want to buy? B. How does the manager offer to put things right?
Are you the manager of this shop?
Yes, I'm the manager.
The service in this store is terrible. I came here for a table, but your assistant over there couldn't be bothered to stop his conversation on his mobile phone. I had to interrupt him, and even then he didn't apologise. Then he took me to the bed section and showed me a wardrobe.
Oh dear.
But that's not all. When I said that wasn't what I wanted, he turned his back on me and walked off.
I'm so sorry to hear that, sir. Let me serve you now personally. Please, come this way.
Well, all right. Are you the manager of this shop?
Yes, I'm the manager.
The service in this store is terrible. I came here for a table, but your assistant over there couldn't be bothered to stop his conversation on his mobile phone. I had to interrupt him, and even then he didn't apologise. Then he took me to the bed section and showed me a wardrobe.
Oh dear.
But that's not all. When I said that wasn't what I wanted, he turned his back on me and walked off.
I'm so sorry to hear that, sir. Let me serve you now personally. Please, come this way.
Well, all right.
That is the last of questions 1 to 6. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. Listen to the following interview with a scientist from Nepal about a national park and the conservation work done there. Then complete the notes below. You will hear the interview twice.
We're very fortunate to have with us today Mahav Mandal, who works for the Department of National Parks and Wildlife Conservation in Nepal. Good evening, Mr. Mandal.
Good evening.
Perhaps you could start by setting the scene and telling us a little about Nepal, as some of our listeners may not be familiar with it.
Of course. Well, we are a small but very remarkable country with an area of just under 148,000 square kilometres, and there are approximately 27 million people living here, with around 2 million Nepalese working overseas. It is between India to the south, east and west, and China to the north. We have no coastline at all. The country is extremely mountainous, and within 150 kilometres, the land rises from sea level to over 8,000 metres.
So the weather conditions must vary a lot within the country.
They certainly do. In our country, you can experience almost all the climate zones found on the planet. And in the northern part of Nepal, we have no fewer than 8 of the world's 10 tallest mountains.
Ah, yes. Nepal is perhaps most famous for its mountains, including Mount Everest, the highest point on Earth. But now, tell us about the park where you work. Let's start with its history.
It's called the Royal Chitwan National Park. Part of it was first set up as a rhinoceros sanctuary in 1960. But then, in 1973, the government declared that the whole region should be protected. In this way, it became the first national park ever established by the Nepalese government. Then, in 1984, it was included on the list of World Heritage Sites because, in those 11 years, the park had built up an excellent reputation for preserving its unique ecosystem.
So, what kind of plants grow in your park?
We have a tropical climate with an annual rainy season, so the park is rich in plant life and vegetation. The great majority of the park is covered with forests of all kinds, but we also have grasslands where you can find the 8-metre-high elephant grass. This offers shelter to animals in hot or wet weather, as well as being used by humans for the construction of walls. There are also shorter types of tuff grass which the people use for thatching roofs, but there are many other kinds of grass for grazing animals.
Tell us about the wildlife in the park.
It's spectacular. There are over 450 species of birds, including the giant hornbill and different types of kingfisher. Then there are more than 43 species of mammals, all found in good numbers, such as leopards and monkeys. Although lately there has been some concern about a decrease in the number of monkeys. But we are developing a good reputation for our work in protecting several endangered species, for example, striped hyenas and river dolphins.
You have had success with protecting your tigers, I hear.
Yes, we are pleased to say that the tiger population across the whole country is now 198, a rise of 63% since 2009.
We are aiming to increase the population of tigers throughout Nepal by 100% before 2020, a deadline agreed by 13 countries.
How on earth do you manage to count the tigers?
We use the latest technology in the form of special cameras to identify the different tigers by their unique stripe patterns. In the future, computers will be used to record the statistics and set up data banks. We also hope to use tracking devices and satellites to track the tiger's movements.
Why is the tiger population still under threat?
Fortunately, tigers are no longer hunted for their fur, but illegal poaching is a constant threat. There can also be a conflict between the needs of tigers and the needs of humans, as they all compete for the same space. Humans want to turn the forests into farmland. However, I am pleased to say that our work in this respect is having some success.
That is indeed a reason to be hopeful.
Now you will hear the interview again.
We're very fortunate to have with us today Mahav Mandal, who works for the Department of National Parks and Wildlife Conservation in Nepal. Good evening, Mr. Mandal.
Good evening.
Perhaps you could start by setting the scene and telling us a little about Nepal, as some of our listeners may not be familiar with it.
Of course. Well, we are a small but very remarkable country with an area of just under 148,000 square kilometres, and there are approximately 27 million people living here, with around 2 million Nepalese working overseas. It is between India to the south, east and west, and China to the north. We have no coastline at all. The country is extremely mountainous, and within 150 kilometres, the land rises from sea level to over 8,000 metres.
So the weather conditions must vary a lot within the country.
They certainly do. In our country, you can experience almost all the climate zones found on the planet. And in the northern part of Nepal, we have no fewer than 8 of the world's 10 tallest mountains.
Ah, yes. Nepal is perhaps most famous for its mountains, including Mount Everest, the highest point on Earth. But now, tell us about the park where you work. Let's start with its history.
It's called the Royal Chitwan National Park. Part of it was first set up as a rhinoceros sanctuary in 1960, but then in 1973, the government declared that the whole region should be protected. In this way, it became the first national park ever established by the Nepalese government. Then in 1984, it was included on the list of World Heritage Sites because in those 11 years, the park had built up an excellent reputation for preserving its unique ecosystem.
So what kind of plants grow in your park?
We have a tropical climate with an annual rainy season, so the park is rich in plant life and vegetation. The great majority of the park is covered with forests of all kinds, but we also have grasslands where you can find the 8-metre-high elephant grass. This offers shelter to animals in hot or wet weather, as well as being used by humans for the construction of walls. There are also shorter types of tuff grass which the people use for thatching roofs, but there are many other kinds of grass for grazing animals.
Tell us about the wildlife in the park.
It's spectacular. There are over 450 species of birds, including the giant hornbill and different types of kingfisher. Then there are more than 43 species of mammals, all found in good numbers, such as leopards and monkeys, although lately there has been some concern about a decrease in the number of monkeys. But we are developing a good reputation for our work in protecting several endangered species,
For example, striped hyenas and river dolphins.
You have had success with protecting your tigers, I hear.
Yes, we are pleased to say that the tiger population across the whole country is now 198, a rise of 63% since 2009. We are aiming to increase the population of tigers throughout Nepal by 100% before 2020, a deadline agreed by 13 countries.
How on earth do you manage to count the tigers?
We use the latest technology in the form of special cameras to identify the different tigers by their unique stripe patterns. In the future, computers will be used to record the statistics and set up data banks. We also hope to use tracking devices and satellites to track the tiger's movements.
Why is the tiger population still under threat?
Fortunately, tigers are no longer hunted for their fur, but illegal poaching is a constant threat. There can also be a conflict between the needs of tigers and the needs of humans, as they all compete for the same space. Humans want to turn the forests into farmland. However, I am pleased to say that our work in this respect is having some success.
That is indeed a reason to be hopeful.
That is the end of question 7. In a moment, you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8. Listen to the following talk about taking books to children in Laos, then complete the following details. You will hear the talk twice.
Welcome to this evening's talk, part of our regular series about how different countries are encouraging young people to read. Our speaker is Chloe, who lives and works in Laos, in Southeast Asia.
Hello. I work for an organisation that improves the education and opportunities of young people in Laos. We have two slogans that really sum up what we try to do. First, forming futures. Second, opening minds. For me, it's the first of these that's the most important. Our work faces many challenges. Schools can be quite basic. So one of our approaches is to help local people build new or better schools, and we help to train them as teachers. Most people in Laos inhabit remote rural areas. Also, roads are often impassable during the hot, rainy season, which lasts from May until November, so transport by car or lorry is a problem for about half the year. Luckily, communication is always possible via satellite. All the problems limit what we can do. Because of the climate, construction work can only take place during the drier season, December to April. November is a particularly hectic time for us, as we are busy preparing materials and loading our trucks. But I've come to talk to you mainly about our new project. I work with the people who live in more than 100 small villages along the banks of the Mekong River. We have set up two floating libraries, boats that each carry more than 1,000 books. There are no other ways of getting books, like bookshops or colleges or resource centres. Over 10,000 Lao children depend totally on these boats for access to books. Let me tell you about a typical visit of the book boat. It usually arrives in the village in the morning. The children go aboard to choose books, then sit nearby and read intently.
The boat stays overnight at the village and children continue to borrow books well past dark. They have to read by candlelight because there are no electric lights or gas lamps in their homes. In the morning, the books are collected and the boat goes to the next village. The boats do not just bring books. The boat staff organise active learning games for part of the day. These games are designed to emphasise the importance and fun of reading, as well as teaching life skills, such as the importance of cleanliness and hand washing. The staff also encourage the preservation of the local culture through teaching traditional dancing and singing. There are, of course, the normal celebrations throughout the year that the children enjoy, but the book boat visits are still a highlight for them. Looking ahead, we hope to expand our programme by buying 2 more boats, if funding is available. We had hoped to find sponsors, but we haven't made much progress in that direction yet. If you are interested in helping us, you could visit our website for more information. Just go online.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Welcome to this evening's talk, part of our regular series about how different countries are encouraging young people to read. Our speaker is Chloe, who lives and works in Laos, in Southeast Asia.
Hello. I work for an organisation that improves the education and opportunities of young people in Laos. We have 2 slogans that really sum up what we try to do. First, forming futures. Second, opening minds. For me, it's the first of these that's the most important. Our work faces many challenges. Schools can be quite basic, so one of our approaches is to help local people build new or better schools, and we help to train them as teachers. Most people in Laos inhabit remote rural areas. Also, roads are often impassable during the hot, rainy season, which lasts from May until November, so transport by car or lorry is a problem for about half the year. Luckily, communication is always possible via satellite. All the problems limit what we can do. Because of the climate, construction work can only take place during the drier season. December to April. November is a particularly hectic time for us, as we are busy preparing materials and loading our trucks. But I've come to talk to you mainly about our new project. I work with the people who live in more than 100 small villages along the banks of the Mekong River. We have set up 2 floating libraries, boats that each carry more than 1,000 books. There are no other ways of getting books, like bookshops or colleges or resource centres. Over 10,000 Lao children depend totally on these boats for access to books. Let me tell you about a typical visit of the book boat. It usually arrives in the village in the morning. The children go aboard to choose books, then sit nearby and read intently. The boat stays overnight at the village and children continue to borrow books well past dark. They have to read by candlelight because there are no electric lights or gas lamps in their homes. In the morning, the books are collected and the boat goes to the next village. The boats do not just bring books. The boat staff organise active learning games for part of the day. These games are designed to emphasise the importance and fun of reading, as well as teaching life skills, such as the importance of cleanliness and hand washing. The staff also encourage the preservation of the local culture through teaching traditional dancing and singing. There are, of course, the normal celebrations throughout the year that the children enjoy, but the book boat visits are still a highlight for them. Looking ahead, we hope to expand our programme by buying 2 more boats, if funding is available. We had hoped to find sponsors, but we haven't made much progress in that direction yet. If you are interested in helping us, you could visit our website for more information. Just go online.
That is the end of question 8. In a moment, you'll hear question 9. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 9. Listen to the following interview with Anita Price, a long-distance swimmer, and then show whether each statement is true or false by putting a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
Today we welcome the long-distance swimmer, Anita Price. Hello, Anita.
Hello.
Perhaps you could tell us about your latest record-breaking achievement.
Well, I've just returned from swimming over 160 kilometres from Cuba to Florida. I knew that had been done several times before, so I wanted to do something different. I decided to become the first person ever to do this swim without any protection against the sharks that infest those waters. I knew that all swimmers previously had used shark cages, a cage they swim inside for their own protection.
I know that you made several attempts when you were younger. What happened the first time?
Well, when I was in my 20s, I was a keen long-distance swimmer, and I broke the world distance swimming record by swimming 165 kilometres from the Bahamas to Florida. I'd managed to ignore the jellyfish and overcome my fear of sharks. Then in 1978, I tried to swim from Cuba to Florida. It was a disaster. Rough seas forced me to stop. After that, I gave up long-distance swimming for 30 years.
What made you think about taking it up again?
Well, when I reached 60, I started thinking about my life and what I had achieved. I knew I needed something, a challenge in my life. I didn't see my age as a problem. At 60, my body was almost as strong as ever, and my mental state was much tougher. I knew I could do it.
How did you prepare for this latest attempt?
I had to raise $300,000 to hire a support team and buy all the equipment. I had to have a medical team with me, as I knew from previous experience that there were many dangers to face. And I had to arrange all the paperwork, visas and so on. But most importantly, I had to build up my swimming stamina.
You must have trained really hard to be able to swim such a distance. Tell us about how you did that. Did you have some special routines to follow?
I swam for 4 hours a day in a pool, and I counted the laps in my head in 4 different languages. The goal is to focus the mind by doing the same thing over and over again. But when I swim in the ocean for a long time, I have a different tactic. I'll sing a song 10 times. I know each one I sing really well, how many seconds each takes, how many strokes. I never lose track.
It obviously works. Did you find the swim straightforward this time?
Definitely not. And this wasn't my first attempt.
So what happened?
The first time, in 2010, I had to stop after 80 kilometres because of an asthma attack. In 2012, the next attempt was stopped because of jellyfish. They paralysed my shoulders. In this last successful swim, I wore a skin-tight bodysuit, a face mask for protection against their stings, and goggles for my eyes. Thank goodness this worked, and I was able to keep going.
160 kilometres through shark-infested water. What an achievement. Are there any important lessons that you can pass on to us?
There are things that I want to tell everyone who asks. One is that you should never give up. Two is that you are never too old to chase your dreams. And three, most important of all, is that any success depends on a team of people working together.
Anita, thank you for coming along today. An inspiring story.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Today we welcome the long-distance swimmer, Anita Price. Hello, Anita.
Hello.
Perhaps you could tell us about your latest record-breaking achievement.
Well, I've just returned from swimming over 160 kilometres from Cuba to Florida. I knew that had been done several times before, so I wanted to do something different. I decided to become the first person ever to do this swim without any protection against the sharks that infest those waters. I knew that all swimmers previously had used shark cages, a cage they swim inside for their own protection.
I know that you made several attempts when you were younger. What happened the first time?
Well, when I was in my 20s, I was a keen long-distance swimmer, and I broke the world distance swimming record by swimming 165 kilometres from the Bahamas to Florida. I'd managed to ignore the jellyfish and overcome my fear of sharks. Then in 1978, I tried to swim from Cuba to Florida. It was a disaster. Rough seas forced me to stop. After that, I gave up long distance swimming for 30 years.
What made you think about taking it up again?
Well, when I reached 60, I started thinking about my life and what I had achieved. I knew I needed something, a challenge in my life. I didn't see my age as a problem. At 60, my body was almost as strong as ever, and my mental state was much tougher. I knew I could do it.
How did you prepare for this latest attempt?
I had to raise $300,000 to hire a support team and buy all the equipment. I had to have a medical team with me, as I knew from previous experience that there were many dangers to face. And I had to arrange all the paperwork, visas and so on. But most importantly, I had to build up my swimming stamina.
You must have trained really hard to be able to swim such a distance. Tell us about how you did that. Did you have some special routines to follow?
I swam for 4 hours a day in a pool, and I counted the laps in my head, in four different languages. The goal is to focus the mind by doing the same thing over and over again. But when I swim in the ocean for a long time, I have a different tactic. I'll sing a song 10 times. I know each one I sing really well, how many seconds each takes, how many strokes. I never lose track.
It obviously works. Did you find the swim straightforward this time?
Definitely not. And this wasn't my first attempt.
So what happened?
The first time, in 2010, I had to stop after 80 kilometres because of an asthma attack. In 2012, the next attempt was stopped because of jellyfish. They paralysed my shoulders. In this last successful swim, I wore a skin-tight bodysuit, a face mask for protection against their stings, and goggles for my eyes. Thank goodness this worked, and I was able to keep going.
160 kilometres through shark-infested water. What an achievement. Are there any important lessons that you can pass on to us?
There are things that I want to tell everyone who asks. One is that you should never give up. Two is that you are never too old to chase your dreams. And three, most important of all, is that any success depends on a team of people working together.
Anita, thank you for coming along today. An inspiring story.
That is the end of question 9. In a moment, you will hear question 10. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 10. Listen to a woman called Rose Mwangi talking about solar power in Kenya, and then indicate which statement, A, B or C, best completes the sentence by putting a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the talk twice.
My name is Rose Mwangi. I've come here today to tell you about a new development in my part of Kenya. First, let me tell you about where I live. My home is in a village in the southwestern part of the country, practically cut off from the rest of the world. We don't have any access to electricity. There are too few of us living there to make it economical to connect us to the national electricity supplies. So until recently, we could not enjoy the pleasures of iced drinks or watching television, things which I expect all of you here in the city take for granted. Now everything has changed. Until recently, most of us used kerosene to light our homes and cook our food. Well, kerosene is a fuel that has been very useful, but there are serious drawbacks. It causes headaches and breathing problems, and often causes house fires. Many women who have spent much of their lives using kerosene find the whites of their eyes have turned red because of the powerful fumes. Apart from all these issues, it costs a good deal of money. Solar energy is the best replacement for kerosene. Thanks to an organisation called the Green Forest Trust, this has become a possibility. The Trust arranges for small groups of women such as myself, many of whom have had no higher education, to learn how the solar apparatus works. We are then taught how to install it, how to keep it in good repair, and how to fix it when anything goes wrong. Where does the money come from for this scheme? Well, we pay for it ourselves. When a village decides that it would like to have solar power, a village energy committee is formed. The committee decides which households should get the solar energy. Everyone in the village makes a contribution, depending on how wealthy they are. This way, even poor people have access to it. The committee also makes sure that the solar engineers do their work properly and are paid a small sum for their work. Now we have solar energy, our village is so much better off. Our families have electric lights so children can study in the evenings. I can charge up my mobile phone at home instead of having to travel 10 kilometres to a friend's house to do it. Everyone now has access to refrigerators, photocopiers and computers. Things which can make life easier and help our children learn and improve their opportunities. Solar energy has also meant that villagers are able to generate small incomes for themselves. For example, the women engineers in our village installed a posho mill. This is a small factory where maize is ground down to make into a flour that can be cooked into a kind of porridge. One man had a widescreen TV installed, and when there is a big football match, villagers can come to enjoy it with him and help to cover the costs.
Now you will hear the talk again.
My name is Rose Mwangi. I've come here today to tell you about a new development in my part of Kenya. First, let me tell you about where I live. My home is in a village in the southwestern part of the country, practically cut off from the rest of the world. We don't have any access to electricity. There are too few of us living there to make it economical to connect us to the national electricity supplies. So until recently, we could not enjoy the pleasures of iced drinks or watching television, things which I expect all of you here in the city take for granted. Now everything has changed. Until recently, most of us used kerosene to light our homes and cook our food. Well, kerosene is a fuel that has been very useful, but there are serious drawbacks. It causes headaches and breathing problems and often causes house fires. Many women who have spent much of their lives using kerosene find the whites of their eyes have turned red because of the powerful fumes. Apart from all these issues, it costs a good deal of money. Solar energy is the best replacement for kerosene. Thanks to an organisation called the Green Forest Trust, this has become a possibility. The Trust arranges for small groups of women such as myself, many of whom have had no higher education, to learn how the solar apparatus works. We are then taught how to install it, how to keep it in good repair, and how to fix it when anything goes wrong. Where does the money come from for this scheme? Well, we pay for it ourselves. When a village decides that it would like to have solar power, a village energy committee is formed. The committee decides which households should get the solar energy. Everyone in the village makes a contribution, depending on how wealthy they are. This way, even poor people have access to it. The committee also makes sure that the solar engineers do their work properly and are paid a small sum for their work. Now we have solar energy, our village is so much better off. Our families have electric lights so children can study in the evenings. I can charge up my mobile phone at home instead of having to travel 10 kilometres to a friend's house to do it. Everyone now has access to refrigerators, photocopiers and computers, things which can make life easier and help our children learn and improve their opportunities. Solar energy has also meant that villagers are able to generate small incomes for themselves. For example, the women engineers in our village installed a posho mill. This is a small factory where maize is ground down to make into a flour that can be cooked into a kind of porridge. One man had a widescreen TV installed, and when there is a big football match, villagers can come to enjoy it with him and help to cover the costs.
That is the end of question 10 and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers. Thank you, everyone.